Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 175.
This week on the podcast, Paul Ryan is adorably optimistic for a guy who just became House Speaker.
And maybe the GOP's distaste for facts explains why their front runner is in fourth place after the third debate. Has the supposed GOP front runner ever even been in the lead yet?
Rubio is on a collision course with fellow candidates and fellow facts.
And the entire media misses the point of the Sanders campaign in their quest to sensationalize Hillary's endorsement pickups.
The Clinton emails continue to prove that Hillary really, really, really doesn't know how to operate a fax machine. Why was this still a problem in 2012?
And a military blimp with an adventurous spirit breaks free of its shackles and goes joy flying around Pennsylvania.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Do that.
Do that for sure. Yeah. Don't let another moment go by without checking out our brilliant blogging.
That's right.
We've been doing a lot of it. This last week we posted about the life story of one Ben Carson.
It's a good one.
He's a man, I will say, and I've been thinking about this a lot, with very, very, like, special hand-eye coordination.
Truly.
He's gifted when it comes to hand-eye coordination, question.
It's just not what I'm looking for in a president,
right.
Necessarily. If they happen to have that in addition to other qualities,
that's fine.
Then that's also fine.
I'm not against a president with hand-eye coordination. No. I'm against a president whose only qualification is that he has hand-eye coordination.
Right.
But if there's one thing that we can compliment Ben Carson on, he's
congrats.
A man.
Congrats. Slow clap to you, Ben Carson.
You have some of the best hand-eye coordination probably out there.
Yep.
Or at least you did, because you're retired. Nobody knows what he's up to now. He might not even have that anymore.
I know. Yeah.
In any case, speaking of Republicans, a lot of Republican news this week.
Yes.
We're going to talk in a bit about the third Republican debate, because that was this week. But first, we have a new Speaker of the House.
Finally, we did.
It's happened. It's real. It's not Kevin McCarthy.
Nope.
It's not John Boehner. It's Paul Ryan. Stupid hat wearing Paul Ryan.
That's right. Backward hat wearing.
Backward hat wearing, dumb muscle tee wearing Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
Who not only felt that it was a good judgment to take dumb photos of himself looking like a 1980s fitness model.
While trying to be vice president.
But also thought that he should become the speaker of a totally unmanageable house.
Yeah.
He's the youngest speaker since 1869.
Oh, congrats
so
to him.
Good work. Well, they had to go younger. No old person would be an idiot, like enough of an idiot to take this job.
I know.
You have to be kind of a young punk to be willing to even try this.
Yeah.
He's the 54th speaker.
Yep.
He
claims that he's going to try and work across the aisle.
Yes, I believe that.
But I believe that he will attempt to ask Democrats to support the insanity that he is going to bring forth to them.
That's true.
And that may, in his mind, be working across the aisle.
Right. It's like if were to offer Brent the opportunity to have his head chopped off, the fact that he says no would mean that he didn't want to work with me on the head chopping off issue.
Right, exactly. You at least offered me the opportunity
to be involved in part of the process.
Right, exactly. And that's what he's going to offer to the Democrats.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because he said in his remarks when, you know, he was... What are they?
Getting sworn
inaugurated? That's not right.
That's not it.
Let's never inaugurate him.
No.
For anything.
For anything. He was getting sworn in.
Sworn in, yeah. He said, a neglected minority will gum up the works. A respected minority will work in good faith.
That seems wrong in this context. In other contexts, maybe fine.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
A logical claim to make.
When he was talking about that minority, he could have been talking about the minority within his own majority party, too, though.
That's
actually
what I think he might have been.
Right. This article, which was actually from the New York Times, I think, was, you know, directing that in the Democrats' way when he said that. But I don't necessarily know that that's
like
what he meant.
That's not... That couldn't, like...
He could have meant it either way, which I guess...
Maybe he's
good job,
master
speechwriters.
Of symbolism.
Yeah, exactly.
He also said, though, let's be frank, the house is broken. We are not settling scores. We are wiping the slate clean. Mm. I also don't believe that's the case.
Nor do I.
That's adorably optimistic, as we said in our rundown, but it is...
Yeah.
It's not a realistic way of looking at the situation.
He did get a good gift from Boehner, though, before, you know,
from lame
taking
duck
over the job, because Boehner was able to get a budget deal passed last week that sort of bought him at least 2 years of having to, you know, decide whether we're going to shut down the government over the budget. Now, we might shut it down over other
things.
Over
the debt ceiling. There's plenty of things to shut
ceiling,
it down over.
They're trying to, you know, impeach the head of the IRS. They're trying, you know, like...
They're busy with
plans. The Freedom Caucus has a lot of reasons that they may want to shut down the government.
Right.
They've got still Planned Parenthood is in their crosshairs. I mean, who knows? But at least he doesn't have to worry about a budget deal for a couple years.
And at least we don't have to worry about a budget deal. Because the Paul Ryan budget of yore was famously terrible.
It's terrible. We're going to get to that
in a little
bit. We're
going to talk about that in a second.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people sort of feel like he's a good figure because he's going to bring the party together, and he could actually be a real leader in the sense that, like, you know, he's talking about working with Democrats and stuff. But, like, you know, it's important to remember that he's awful.
Right. Yeah. We have a lot of ways to remind you that he's awful, because he ran for vice president, as you might recall. Uh-huh. So we have a lot of information about his awfulness that came to us, gifted to us in 2012.
Yeah. Well, he's a man who is known only for being the GOP budget whiz kid. Yeah. I mean, that's his thing. He's on the budget committee. He's, you know, he does budgets. That's who Paul Ryan is.
So he's laugh a minute.
And all, exactly, yes. And all of his budgets are the worst.
They're the worst budgets.
Yeah.
They're the kind of budgets that cut everything that's good for humanity and increase spending of everything that you're not supposed to want to increase spending on, like killing people.
Right, exactly.
Military operations of sorts. Uh-huh. He's famous for being real no holds barred when it comes to cutting Social Security, which is rare even in the Republican circles, because even Republicans know that it's... I once heard it compared to the NHS in Britain, where, like, Social Security is one system that Americans really won't stand for losing. And I think, you know, they think they're making some progress with our generation, because many of us don't believe there will be Social Security when we get older.
Right.
Now, of course, everyone ignores the simple fact that if we raise the cap, you know, the cap on wages...
Except Bernie Sanders,
who said it in the debate. Exactly, because
he knows.
But I mean, everyone sort of who doesn't know that thinks that we're not going to have Social Security. Right. So they're making some progress with people our age believing that we probably should cut Social Security because we'll never get it anyway, and why do we want to pay into it?
Exactly. He also doesn't... Apparently, Paul Ryan is not a man who understands, you know, irony either.
No.
Because he is...
For a man who's so into cutting Social Security, he has an interesting life story to show for it.
Because his father... died when he was 16, and he was able to get the survivor benefits through Social Security, and that was what paid his way through college, by the way.
Social Security pays your way through college so you can become a congressman and then cut everyone else's Social Security benefits.
Right, a tale as old as time.
A tale as old as Republican time.
Yes, exactly.
So that's a real kick in the pants.
Yeah. But the other way that he paid through college was by working three jobs, which is what he thinks that all people who are going to college should
do. This is my favorite thing that grumpy old people say, and he's not old enough or grumpy enough for this to have been a thing that he said.
No,
grumpy old people like to pull the whole, I walk 20 miles in the snow, so why are you complaining about walking 3 miles in the snow with no shoes on?
Yeah.
Like, and that's like what gets directed at millennials a lot, because everyone likes to act like they're lazy. But this is actually also a tale as old as time. It's a tale of old people trying to imply that the young generation's problems, which were caused by them, the old people, are their own fault.
Yeah.
So he's sort of doing the same thing here. But here's the thing. It's like when the 53% were doing those, like, you know, during Occupy, and there was that, like, protest movement with the 53%, and they were all posting signs that were like, I have four jobs and $5 million in student loans, and I don't need the government's help. And you'd be like, you actually kind of do need the government's help. Wouldn't it be better if you didn't have to work seven jobs? Wouldn't it be easier to just not work seven jobs? Do you deserve to work seven jobs? That seems crazy.
Exactly.
He's sort of being like, well, I worked three jobs, so everyone should suffer.
This is another classic Republican answer to people's problems, which is, go get a job. As if we could all just go get jobs.
Right. And as if all those jobs pay a living wage, so we should have no problem making ends meet once we have that job.
Yeah, exactly. But he wanted to cut, you know, he was going to let student loan interest rates double. His budget was going to slash Pell Grants. So, you know, he's a man who really...
And he wanted to deregulate the student loan industry.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which is already pretty predatory.
It is. Yeah, it definitely is. He is... while the economy was tanking and when it was in sort of, you know, its initial recovery, he voted nine times between 2003 and 2012 against extending unemployment benefits.
Yeah, because you should figure it out on your own. If you're unemployed, figure it out.
Get a job. That's it. There aren't any, but find one.
Find one and just get it.
Yeah, exactly. He's got a real love of Ayn Rand.
Real love, I know.
Big time.
Yeah. He gave copies of Ayn Rand books as Christmas presents to his staffers.
Right, which is funny because Ayn Rand is a big, you know, her whole thing is selfishness.
Right, so, like, and to how the importance of it, how we need it in order to, like... Right.
So again, another point in Ryan's career where he is not seeing irony.
No.
Because he's being unselfish by giving gifts.
Most recently, he's been a real non-irony seer because in part of him, one of his requirements for taking this job as speaker was that he wanted to make sure he would get time to spend with his family.
Yes.
But he has regularly voted against paid family leave.
Yeah.
All the time.
And all the time.
And he's somebody who I think has even extended it to his staffers. from time to time, but, like, won't allow other Americans right. to have it.
Well, and he's even been asked about this. Fox News, of all places, yeah. asked him about this. And because right now, we have Family Medical Leave Act, but it doesn't...
You don't get paid.
You don't get paid for it. So you can take it, but you don't get paid.
If somebody in your family is sick or someone has a baby, you can take 12 weeks and not lose your job, but you don't get paid for that 12 weeks.
So he and the Republicans have blocked this many times because Obama has called to allow that the workers be paid while they do this. So
which they are in every other like civilized nation. Yeah, of course.
So when he got asked about it, he said, "I don't think people ask me to be speaker so that I can take more money from hardworking taxpayers to create some new federal entitlement. But I think people want to have members of Congress who represent them, that are like them. But you're not, because you have paid family leave time.
Exactly.
So, like, that's the point.
That's the point.
Do you see what we're getting at here, Paul Ryan?
Like,
he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
Doesn't see it. Yeah. Anyway. But, you know, he's proposed cutting food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, children's health care. So, I mean, like we said, he may want to work with Democrats on some of these things, but, I mean, like, they're not going to work with him on that.
In the same way that Brent doesn't want to work with me on cutting his own head off. Right. They're not going to want to work on cutting Social Security.
So good luck to you.
Yeah, it seems like a real winning strategy you have moving forward.
Yes. But he's got a vision.
Yes.
We don't necessarily know what it is.
What we know is that he knows that Republicans currently don't have a vision.
One. So he's going to get one.
So he's going to get one eventually.
Yes.
He's figuring it out.
That's right.
Stay tuned.
Yes.
Paul Ryan will find a vision.
Yeah. He says, "We've been too timid on policy. We've been too timid on vision. We have none.
That's wild, since the only thing they haven't been too timid on is they've been too timid on reality. But they're not timid on policy.
No.
They're planning to get rid of Obamacare. They have voted to defund Obamacare 61 times.
Once they find a policy they like,
they'll keep voting on it until the cows come home.
Yeah.
They're not too timid on vision. Their vision is absolutely batshit insane and flies in the face of all logic, and they're still committed to it.
Maybe that's what he meant.
Maybe that's what he meant.
Just didn't feel comfortable saying that.
That's probably that was it.
Probably
that
was smart. It. Yeah.
He said, "We've taken plenty of tactical risks here in Congress. I believe it's time to take some policy risks." Mm. Yes. Nothing.
Joy.
Well, I would argue that it was a little risky to so vehemently oppose the Affordable Care Act, considering that it was originally a policy that they proposed.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think they're taking some serious risks.
They are.
They're being unpredictable.
Yes, that's
risky.
Yeah. But he also said, gave a hint as to one commitment that he gave to members of his own party when taking this job, and it was that he was not going to take up an immigration reform package while Obama is the president. Which is bonkers for a couple different reasons. Because, well, what he said specifically on this issue, you cannot trust the president. And I get where he's going on this, because his point was, because he went on to say, is that the president has tried to write the laws himself here.
Right.
The reason the president has tried to write the laws himself is because the Senate has passed a bipartisan immigration policy, and the House just won't vote on it.
Right.
So if he thinks the president shouldn't be making laws and Congress should be making laws, then his Congress should make the law. Or if he doesn't want to make the law himself, then he can just vote on the one that's already been made.
Right.
It's ridiculous that he just like won't bring it up to either a vote or at least work on it. Like, if you're mad that the president is writing the laws and your answer is Congress should write the laws,
then write a fucking law that can pass Congress.
Then the answer is not to not do it.
No.
That doesn't make any sense.
Also, the laws originate in Congress. They don't have to be written by Congress. If a law originates in Congress, then it is a law from Congress.
Right, exactly.
If they are not writing a law that the president wants to see action on, he is entitled to write a law. He can't pass it unilaterally because he's the president and not Congress.
But it's
too much.
Yeah.
It's too ridiculous for words.
Yeah.
And from there, let's talk about another thing that was too ridiculous for words. The second GOP debate. The third GOP debate. Largely content-free debate.
It was.
Thanks to Donald Trump and Ben Carson's insistence that there not be any chance for anyone to debate during the debate.
Right, because Trump made sure that it was 2 hours long, and also they all made sure that they had opening and closing statements.
Right.
So it left very little time to actually have
any content. It left them
with,
like, 30 seconds here and there to respond to each other. So what they did instead was get into, like, weird quibbles.
That's right. Yes.
Which is what I was looking for anyway.
That's why we watch.
Exactly. And also, there was a lot of flack directed at the CNBC anchors, which I think is largely unfair because they were handed, like, a completely unmanageable slate of debaters and then no time to get them to answer any questions.
That's true.
And I understand that their questions were not super hard-hitting, but I also feel like, how do you ask Ben Carson a hard-hitting question?
Well, but they were hard. They were hard-hitting, but they were hard-hitting, at least,
in
the wrong way. Look, that was more entertaining. Yeah. And
they were considering that they were insisting on having Donald Trump participate despite the fact that he was making their lives difficult,
right.
They were looking for a sensationalistic debate. They were not looking for a quality debate.
So in terms of entertainment, it was top-notch. In terms of
learning anything about the presidential field, bottom-notch. So
Bingo. Yes, exactly.
Here's some things, though, that we sort of took away.
That we learned.
Yeah. One is that Jeb Bush is not a real person.
No, it was like, a lot of people are like, pointing to that debate as like the beginning of the end for Jeb Bush.
He's not a real contender.
Because as we know, because we talked about it last week, he was having a bad week going into this debate. We had just found out last week that he had cut his staff. And so everybody was like looking for him. He was supposed to have a great debate to sort of like have his donors get off his back. People were worried about his candidacy. It was like he needed to have a good night to have, you know, cast away any doubts that his campaign was in the shitter. And it went quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So he spoke by far the least of any of the 10 candidates there. And it was, I think, in large part due to the fact that he had a face-off that went terribly wrong for him in the very early portion of the debate and, like, never really came back from it. And I think that that's probably why. He went away after that clash with Marco Rubio, where he, like, got used and abused by Marco Rubio.
It was very awkward.
In a very embarrassing way, I thought. Like, I mean, it was bad for him. And everybody knew it.
He said something weird about giving a warm kiss to the Democrats.
Yeah, so he said a lot of weird things. Yeah, there was a warm kiss to the Democrats. He talked about his fantasy football team because one of the hard-hitting questions was whether the government should be regulating those, like, fantasy football websites. Like, you know, that's why, like, come on.
Right, those are ridiculous.
I mean, like, I get that, like, that is an issue and a lot of people play in those things. But, like, this was supposed to be the debate, like, where we talked about things that affect people's lives.
Right.
And, like, that's just
not it. We're supposed to talk about the economy in this debate.
This was the economy debate on CNBC, because that's what they do.
Right.
And it's not like these were a bunch of liberals either. One of the guys asking the question is the guy who coined the term Tea Party. I mean, these CNBC people are, like, economy people who are not, like, claiming liberals.
All of them looked completely unfamiliar to me.
I'd never seen
a single one on television.
Oh, yeah, me too. I know. Yeah.
If they are people that are on television, that is news to me.
Yeah.
Because I had never seen any of them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But the person who really won the night was Marco Rubio.
Big time.
Not just because he had this exchange with Jeb Bush, and not just because he even, like, had similar exchanges with some other candidates.
Right.
It was because he was the one who came away looking like the establishment's only hope.
He seemed to be, like, the reasonable person in the room, other than John Kasich, who was sort of, like,
John Kasich was on the literal end of the stage.
Yeah, exactly, which Donald Trump called out at one point.
Exactly.
Like, as Kasich was railing on him. But anyway. Rubio is, like, the guy who seems like he could maybe be the guy, I guess. I mean,
he's the hope, at least.
He's the hope.
He's the fourth place hope.
Yeah, but anyway, this clash that happened with Bush, we should just tell it to you, because it was pretty great.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably saw it, but, like, if you didn't, it was genius. Because what happened was, earlier in that very day, actually, and I think that is why Bush probably shouldn't have gone there, because Rubio knew this question was going to get asked.
Because, and was prepped for
because it. His home, one of the Florida home papers, the Sun Sentinel, came out with an op-ed that said that he should retire from the Senate while he's running for president, because he's missing all of his votes.
Right.
He, like, missed, like, 60% of his votes or something. So they asked him about that, and he had his answer ready to go. He said, you know, I missed, all the senators are missing votes. He said Obama, who they endorsed, missed almost the same percentage of votes that I have missed. And so it's obviously just a media double standard. So he got a good media jab in there, which
the
everybody loved.
That.
And so, Bush came back and was like, oh, what is
Bush's
it?
Bush's response, P.S., was hilarious, because he was like, well, I'm a constituent of Rubio's, and I'm not happy that he's missing all these votes.
Yeah, exactly. And then he was like, isn't it like a French work week? Don't you only work 3 days a week? And Rubio was like, first off, you endorsed McCain, who was missing a ton of votes while he was in there. And then he was like, you're only doing this. He says, someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you, but I'm not running against Jeb Bush or anyone else on this stage. I'm running for president because there's no way we can elect Hillary Clinton. And the crowd just, like, went bonkers.
He got to look like a hero.
But he got to look like a hero, and Jeb Bush got to look like the giant fuck-up that he
is. Yes.
Yeah. So that went great for him. He also had another really great applause line, because they were talking about super PACs. And he said the Democrats have the biggest super PAC of all, because they have and he said it's the liberal media, or the mainstream media.
Media.
Yeah. And that
That got a huge response from the focus groups that were...
Right, exactly. It got, like, a Frank Luntz, who's a big, you know, GOP pollster, said that like, got the first 90-plus dial score of the night. It wasn't the highest of the night, though, because we're going to get to that in a second. It came from somebody else who people think had a pretty good night at that debate, too.
After the debate, Paul Singer, who's one of the big super PAC contributors in the GOP side, and Bush and Christie had both been really trying to get him onto their team, went and backed Rubio. So he took home a big prize.
Yeah, he did.
Trump was nowhere to be found.
Right.
He had one zinger at Kasich at the beginning of the night, and then
it wasn't even really a zinger. It was just your poll numbers are bad. Which is his go-to answer, like when someone on one of the ends...
He's very
like,
transparent.
Yeah, exactly.
He always goes with the whole... He deflects by changing the subject to poll numbers. So that was sort of like the... And Ted Cruz had a fairly good night as well. He's the other person that people say kind of like won, at least in the sense that he came out with a favorable sort of impression.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Well, he saw how well Rubio's, you know, hating of the media played in the room.
And went
to him. He was like, I can do that too.
Yes.
And he went for it. And it was the highest score from Frank Luntz's polling group. Yeah, it got 98. Oh, it's actually the highest in 15 years that Frank Luntz has been doing this at a debate, actually. Yeah, 98. Got a 98 score. And also with moderates, too. The moderates love that. It wasn't just like the Ted Cruz fringe nuts.
Well, you know what he was doing? he was doing something that has been working for Trump, really, a lot of the time, and kind of like calling out a kind of corruption that everyone knows sort of exists. You know, where he's talking about them being lobbed dumb questions and them being typecast and them, you know, being the media sort of spinning this campaign in a way that doesn't actually focus on the issues. Yeah. Now, I would argue that there are no issues to focus on when Donald Trump and Ben Carson are your front runners in a campaign. Brent and I have a slight disagreement over whether these should have content, these debates.
Well, I agree. And I would, but I think the way to go about this is to let them have a chance at the content,
right,
and then for us to see that they don't have any.
No, like, I see that being the case. I also see, though, that there is no mechanism in place to make this happen, because these debates, even unlike the CNN debate that the Democrats did, they required CNN to show it, to stream it free to everyone.
Yeah.
None of these Republican debates have been free to anyone without cable. Yeah. So you are talking about... These are about ad revenue. You're talking about cable companies that want to get eyeballs.
That's true.
And you're talking about a campaign that is dominated, not just sort of controlled, but dominated by entertainment figures. They're not. Right. It's not dominated by serious candidates.
Totally.
And so there's no way that CNBC sees this field, sees that in the smack the middle of the stage is going to be Ben Carson and Donald Trump.
Right. Let's ask themselves serious questions.
Let's talk about the economy a little. Like, that's just not how they are going to get viewers. That's not how they're going to get tweets. That's not how they're going to get anyone to talk about what happened at this debate. Because all of these clashes were great news stories.
No, I agree with you on those points.
Yeah.
And I think the reason that they were asking those questions is for the very reason that you were saying.
Yeah.
All I am saying is
that... It'd be nice if they didn't have to do that.
It'd be nice, A, that if they didn't have to do that. And as much as I hate all 10 of those people, it's also not fair to them.
No. No, of course not.
Like, that was my,
it's
I guess,
It's not fair to the
point.
American people, because we're going to have to watch a million of these debates. And the whole point is that we find out if any of them are fit to be president, and we'll never find that
out. We'll never know.
Because Donald Trump's not fit, and he's dominating the cycle.
Right, exactly.
Even when he's not on stage, even when he wasn't talking, his presence kind of dominates what they can and can't talk about.
Yeah,
And Ben Carson, too.
Yeah.
And, Ben Carson, no one ever attacks, because he seems so gentle.
Right, that was the other thing, too, because, we were wondering, because Carson
is now
polling in first place nationally
in
some new polls that had just come out last week. So a lot of people going in were like, well, are people going to take down Carson? And they asked Trump about that, because Trump was fine throwing some insults.
Right.
And even Trump said, no, I'm not going to do
it's
it.
Too
because
scary.
Because they all know
he's like a wounded
that they can't
deer.
Do it.
It's like insulting a baby. It's like not.
That's it. His likability numbers are so high in these polls that going after him doesn't do
he's
you
like
any good.
He's got those sleepy eyes.
Yeah.
And he seems like he's trying to be a nice guy. You know, it seems like he doesn't, he lacks empathy. He's a sociopath, but
he even said that at one point in the night, he wasn't a homophobe. He goes, just because I don't believe in gay marriage doesn't mean I'm a homophobe.
Yeah. No, he's sort
which
of like,
I would contend
he's
meandering, that it does, but I mean.
He's meandering his way through the issues. It feels unfair to attack him because he doesn't have the same advantages the rest of them have in terms of knowing facts.
Yeah.
Some of them are knowing facts and choosing not to share those facts in the way that they are meant to be understood.
Agreed. Yeah.
Ben Carson is sort of lacking the facts in the first place. So it's not nice to talk. You don't want to be the guy who took down the baby.
No.
That's not, you wouldn't you know, it's like, yeah. It's too unfair.
I agree. I'm with you.
And yeah. Also, he's a fucking hero of science. So you don't want to be the guy that right. couldn't respect the one hero of science the Republicans can look up to.
I know. Yeah, exactly. We would be remiss to leave talk oh, yeah. of the debate without at least mentioning the undercard debate, because it was the Lindsey Graham comedy hour. And who knew that he had
who
that
knew
in
that
him?
He had... what a shock.
Nobody. Nobody knew.
Yeah.
But he did. It was just like... zinger after zinger after zinger, and
he came
was getting
prepared.
A lot of applause. I'm surprised that he sort of like is not getting the love that sort of like Fiorina was able to have right. after her initial kitty debate. I mean, he did well enough that like he should certainly be more of a reasonable person to put on the stage than some of those other.
Well, he's
ten
much more
goons.
Of a legitimate
he's
contender.
A legitimate person, right?
Right. He's not a legitimate contender, I guess. He's a
no.
legitimate person.
Person, right? Exactly. Yeah.
He's a politician. He's a professional yeah. politician.
Yeah, but he said, but he was like, as he was shouting a lot in this debate. He normally doesn't get very worked up.
No.
But he said, "I'm tired of losing. Good God, look who we're running against. The number one candidate on the other side, Hillary Clinton, thought she was flat broke after her and her husband were in the White House for 8 years. And the number two guy, Bernie Sanders, went to the Soviet Union on his honeymoon, and I don't think he ever came back." But it was, he was right. Every time he spoke, it was something like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, he was killing it.
Yeah.
It's a mission. I mean, I guess they were sort of like, listen, Lindsay,
let's
need to do
it.
Something here.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So let's, there's not going to be any content. You're in a debate with Bobby Jindal and you know, like, right. it's like not real people in that debate.
Yeah, I know.
P.S. Oh, we forgot to put this on the doc, but that hilarious story about that hunting conversation between Mike Huckabee, Bobby Jindal and Ted Cruz.
I know.
We'll post this because it's like, we were going to do a dramatic reading, but then we couldn't find anyone to come on and do it with us.
We
needed a third person. It's like this funny like conversation that Politico like basically scripts out.
Yeah.
That is between Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, and Bobby Jindal, and all about...
Because they were all in Iowa
were all
this weekend,
in Iowa
and, like,
this weekend.
Somebody was hosting them, and they were, like, going hunting or
yeah,
whatever.
And
so they
with
were,
Chuck
like,
Grassley.
They were talking about hunting, and then they were also talking about when people were going to be there, and somebody was,
and
like...
they were making jokes about shooting each
shooting
other.
Shooting each other, which... right.
Which I guess is Republican humor that I don't quite get.
Yeah.
And then they were also making jokes about PETA.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They really... that's one that they can all get behind, yeah. is hating PETA.
Yeah.
In any case...
The polling is starting to move a little bit, not necessarily at the
but
top. But
hilariously, it's not moving at the top
at
all.
It's not moving at the top
and
at all.
And it's only the like 4th through 7th place that ever moves.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
I know.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Because after we told you about, you know, Rubio winning the evening and becoming
right.
the new perceived frontrunner, he's
the
now really...
the perceived frontrunner at 9%.
He's crushing it in 4th place at 9%.
Right. Cruz, by the way, is at 10%.
10%,
and
yeah.
Trump and Carson are at 26%.
Yeah.
So, like, they don't even... it's, like, not even in the same scale of things.
No, I know. Yeah, our perceived frontrunner is in single digits, by
right.
the way.
Yeah, along with Jeb Bush. He's
Jeb
only
Bush
got 4 points on Jeb Bush.
At 5%.
Jeb Fiorina. Bush only has 1 point on Fiorina. And Christy
yeah.
Huckabee, Kasich, and Paul are all at 2%.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I mean, they're all still about as legitimately contendery as the rest of them.
Basically,
aside
yeah.
from Trump and Carson, the rest
yeah.
of them are all 10 or under.
Yeah. Well, and what's so interesting about this, and I hear a lot of people say this, and I think where Bush needs to be concerned is definitely of Rubio, because he's
yeah.
the other establishment person. But either Rubio and Bush are at 9 and 5%, but the common thinking is that the three above them are, at some point, everyone is going to decide can't
right.
be the guy. Now, you can debate whether that is actually how it's going to go down or not.
Right. This is based largely on the last election cycle where that happened.
Yes, exactly.
Where every 2 minutes we'd cycle through
right.
a new candidate. Because remember, Herman Cain led the polls for
yeah,
a
exactly.
brief time.
But what I would say, and we have said this on the podcast before, is that in 2012, you always had the sense that at some point they would get around to deciding
right.
on Mitt Romney. Like, even
right.
when...
he never
even,
fully embarrassed himself.
Right? You just don't get the sense that
no.
this electorate is going to get around to Bush or Rubio.
No, and this is very... I mean, this is... their electorate is evolving in a really weird way, so it's hard to, like, understand what... because Romney had, like, a bizarre amount of opposition. They decided very late in the game to finally go with him.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, like, the last... breath of the establishment Republicans, basically.
Yeah.
And it was because there was one candidate that seemed like the guy to put your money behind, because
yeah.
he was the establishment guy. This is very confusing.
Yeah.
You don't see that here. You see the establishment people collectively have 14%. That's less than the two leaders do anyway.
Right.
Everyone else on the stage is an insane person.
That's right.
Even if you add Fiorina to their total, you're not at 20% yet. Cruz is not in the same realm as Rubio, despite the fact that biographically they share a lot.
Yeah.
But, like, and also, there's the issue with Cruz of whether or not he's even qualified to run for president.
No.
So there's a lot to talk about with him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he feels like a trend, because he's evangelical and a nutbag.
Yeah.
And he also shut down the government. I don't think that general election voters would care for that. And I think ultimately that would bump him out of the primary.
I agree.
But this Carson and Trump situation really points to the fact that those voters are looking to vote for anyone but an establishment candidate. Yeah. And so, like, they can keep trying to find the next guy who could be the establishment candidate.
Right.
But it's going to be hard to break through these numbers when two people are leading the polls
who
are both insane.
Yeah, 52% of people are voting for either Trump
or
Carson.
For an insane person. Who's not qualified.
Who's not qualified and not establishment. Those 52% of people are not going to all of a sudden decide to flock to Jeb Bush. It's just not going to happen.
No.
They might flock to Carly Fiorina, or they
Huckabee
might
would be a great option for them.
Right, exactly. You know. Although even he is sort of, I mean, he's fringy, but he's establishment.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like a governor of a real place.
Huckabee is the most establishment I think those voters could probably get to.
Yeah.
And that is not anywhere near the neighborhood that Rubio or Jeb Bush live in.
No.
I mean, that's still Banana Town.
Yeah. So
crazy pants.
It's interesting. But Cruz, that was a pretty big jump for Cruz into third place there at 10% into double digits.
I see him jumping back down eventually.
I agree, but it was in large part due to the fact because the people who responded in this poll said that he won the debate.
Yeah.
24% said that he won the
debate.
Well,
he had all those great media zingers,
exactly.
You know?
And 20%,
media zingers will get you.
Rubio was right behind him at 20%. And when they asked who lost the debate, it was Jeb Bush going away at 38%.
Aww.
I mean, going away.
Well,
yikes.
Hilariously, Jeb Bush, as we're going to talk about in a little while, knows that he's bad at debating.
Yes.
He admitted as much on a call with his a fundraising call earlier.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, Carson's camp is hoping to really, like, take this trend of him and Trump taking on the media to make the debate irrelevant.
Yeah.
And, like, really, like, galvanizing the rest of the team to make it even dumber.
Right. This story also further proves his
lack
trouble
of
with math.
Exactly. they are spearheading a meeting today, Sunday, in Washington to figure out how to kind of like upend the debate system so that the candidates mostly just have opening and closing statements and don't really have to debate much.
Yeah.
Their proposal would eliminate most of the debating portion because they want to give all the candidates 5 minutes minimum for opening and closing statements. That's 10 minutes a candidate.
Yeah.
Now, if you add all of that together, plus all of the time that you need to like just have, you know, the moderators say nonsense things and commercials.
That's,
you have over 2.5 hours of debating, and you haven't
debated
anything.
Yeah.
And Carson then went on this week on ABC and said that he wants, at a minimum, 1 minute. So he lowered his expectations a little. But then to have tighter guidelines regarding the response portion, because a lot of people take way more time than they're supposed to on their responses, and no moderator has been able to get this under control. I know they said that about the CNBC people. They were given a pretty hard task in asking all those people to only take 30 seconds to respond to these things.
I mean,
that's
come on.
Crazy.
Yeah.
This is the most out-of-control debate peanut gallery I can possibly imagine. But so he was complaining that some people get more time because they talk more and the people that are following the rules aren't getting as much. This just goes back to him being sort of like adorably like idiotic about what's going on.
Yeah.
But in any case, if their demands are met, we can look forward to debates that run as many as a million hours long.
Right. And nobody will watch those.
No.
By the way.
No, that's not good television.
No.
Donald Trump led us to good television. He didn't lead us to good things for America, but he led us to good television.
Yeah.
Ben Carson is trying to take away good television and lead us to something that's both useless.
Screw you,
it's just
Ben
like
Carson.
A campaign announcement for each candidate and then good night.
Yeah.
That's nobody needs that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the New York Times this week got really busy describing all the collision courses Rubio's campaign is on, which is how we know everyone's considering him the front runner.
Yeah.
Again, he's at 9%. But
that's right.
Fourth place. The New York Times is considering him the front runner because they think that he is both on a collision course with Jeb Bush, which we've talked about a bit in the past, and also on a collision course with Ted Cruz.
Oh, yeah.
So he's on a collision course with anyone. Anyone and everyone.
That's right.
The Bush-Rubio collision course, we've talked about a little. We talked a little bit about how they were trying to one-up each other on the fundraising game.
Yeah.
Where they were all talking about how they had more money in their war chest
on
hand. So they've already been sort of directing jabs at each other. Obviously, the conversation got a little more pointed during the debate. But then after the debate, Rubio's people went wild trying to get all of the Bush donors to come over to their side. And they nailed
one.
They nabbed an in-play guy.
Yeah.
But so they basically, the thing that they can't compete in is money. They can compete in anything else. Obviously, there's more excitement behind Marco Rubio than Jeb Bush. And there's more sort of like ground level participation, I think. But there is not more rich person enthusiasm.
No,
because Jeb Bush is a bush.
That's right.
So he wins de facto in the rich person attracting yes, game because he yeah. went to prep school with all yeah. of them.
Although the one thing that I will say, and you know, Sheldon Adelson has sort of at least this election cycle famously said that he wants to pick somebody who's going to win, and
yeah.
I think that a lot of these sort of like big money guys have sort of in the past supported the ideologue
right.
who agrees with them the most. And it seems like maybe they're willing to not do that this time around.
Well, it's a waste of money.
It's a waste of money,
just
right?
to get the American embassy in Israel
right.
moved
and back
from
Newt Gingrich? Like,
Tel
Aviv
to Jerusalem. That's not worth it.
No.
What do we gain from doing that?
Yeah, exactly.
You just lose millions of dollars on a man who just wanted to go shopping and go on a zoo tour of America.
Yeah, that's right.
Took a 2-week vacation right after he declared that he was running. I mean. That's
so,
not a plan.
It seems like the GOP sugar daddies are maybe willing to sort of
play actual ball this
try
time.
And, try and decide who might win. And they think that Marco Rubio might win. And Jeb Bush, I think, hilariously said, hey, guys, Marco Rubio is just the Barack Obama
yes.
of the current GOP party right now. He's not. He doesn't have the experience.
That's
he
right.
does. He doesn't have any accomplishments to his name. He's only our Barack Obama.
So let's look at that another way. He's only the most popular and effective. He's only our version of the most popular and effective and exciting and charismatic leader that the Democrats have.
I mean, what a ridiculous thing to say about someone.
Also, that's what everyone's been saying about Marco Rubio, who likes him.
I know.
That's not a threat.
No, it's not a...
He's the Barack Obama. Like, Bush is obviously trying to claim that we need, like, serious governing experience
correct.
In there.
Yeah.
But Bush himself barely offers that. And...
True.
The only thing he does offer is that he harkens back to a time when we were very unhappy with our leadership.
Yeah, exactly.
So the whole thing yeah. is a bit of a mess. I'm curious to know where this goes because Jeb Bush admitted on this call, as we said, with donors
right.
that he's not a great debater. He said, debates are not my forte. And then said... And then said he was going to go to the gym for an hour, like, on the call. So his own supporters are starting to think, like, does he even want this?
Care about
does
this?
Does he care about this at all? And then one of his backers said something that I think is sort of hilarious.
Yeah.
He said, I think the real Jeb Bush is positive and optimistic and very policy-oriented. And to the extent that they try to get him to be something other than that, they're simply distracting from the real Bush.
Ooh.
There is no real Bush there. That's
no.
an insane notion to think yeah. there's a real Bush there somewhere. That's absurd.
Yeah.
But so in
also,
any case, there
the real Bush isn't positive and optimistic.
No,
by the way,
the real Bush
either.
Is maybe a little bit of a bully and a reformed
yeah.
pothead.
He's certainly not likable.
He's not likable.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
But those campaigns are getting a little bit more aggressive with each passing day. It's hilarious because Marco Rubio famously has said that Bush was a mentor to him.
Yeah.
They're supposedly friends. They're competing, for this major swing state. It's like it's too. Delicious
yeah, exactly.
to unpack.
Yeah.
But then there's also the Rubio-Cruz collision course.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this one coming.
Well, here's why. Rubio and Cruz are offering up the same inspiring biography.
Sure.
In what at one time was very similar packages, but Rubio has moved to the left, I guess is what you would say.
I guess.
To the middle. And Cruz...
I hate to say that.
Right?
But.
Cruz... And he has really tried to distance himself from Cruz. And Cruz... had initially, you know, they had talked a little bit, he compared himself a lot to Rubio when he was running.
Yeah.
And so Cruz kept trying to go visit him in Washington while he was running, and Rubio kept not meeting with him
right.
and putting him in meetings with his staffers.
Yeah, like,
so,
get rid of this guy for
right,
me.
So they had sort of, like, talked through staffers briefly, but didn't really have, like, a personal rapport. And
yeah.
then Cruz was really looking for Rubio's endorsement, and Rubio did not endorse him.
Yeah.
Rubio's trying to not be this guy. He came in a Tea Party wave. He was a little bit of a
right.
crazy
he's trying
person.
To be seen
he's
as, like, the sort
seen
of pragmatic,
legit person.
Legitimate person. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
So now Cruz is telling his friends and his supporters that he thinks that the GOP primary is going to come down to him and Rubio. And they're starting to try to, like, stake out slightly opposite positions without pissing off their base.
Right.
So it's getting, it's like, I can see the parallels. You know, they're the same age, we learned, which is very disturbing, considering that Ted Cruz looks to be about 15 years older than Marco Rubio.
At least.
At least.
Like, he could have potentially fathered him.
Evil eyes will do that to you.
That's
guys.
Right.
Evil
yeah.
eyes age you.
They're both 44.
That's, isn't it crazy that Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz is less than 10 years older than I am.
Oh, God. Oh, that's terrible.
Isn't that upsetting?
That's very upsetting.
It's upsetting.
That's very upsetting. I don't even know if I can go on knowing
know.
That. That's
I know.
The fact that they're both 44 also is like...
Yeah.
Why is everyone who's a possible contender in this race so young?
I know.
Like, But in any case, they would both be our first Latino president.
Sure.
If they came. It's worth reminding everyone that they're both Cuban.
That's right.
They're not South American or Latin American in the traditional sense. They're part of this ultra-conservative Cuban community. So I don't know that they actually relate to the story of the rest of the Latino community that strongly.
Yeah.
They certainly have never been held to the same immigration standards.
Right.
Because Cubans can just show up here and then they get to be Americans. So they don't necessarily...
Or show up in Canada.
Marco
and have
Rubio
children in Canada.
Have children in Canada as Canadian citizens.
Right.
Give birth to another Canadian citizen and then have that Canadian citizen later become an American citizen at the age of 6 and then run for president.
Right.
But Rubio did try to kind of join that bipartisan effort with Lindsey Graham and McCain to do immigration reform, and then sort of famously kind of backpedaled his way out of it when that failed.
And that's what the big
and
that's
his,
what his that the big drawback to him for a lot of the people who might support him,
one of them
who are supporting Cruz,
because
and even I think I told you this actually, you know, my lone Republican friend, you know, said this actually too, because I have told him, you know, my fears of Marco Rubio being the nominee and potentially winning, because I can see a world where that happens. And he was like, well, he's not going to get the nomination because he got himself all mired in that immigration bill. And it's like, really? Like,
it's hilarious that he would consider it something to be mired in.
That's why you're not going to nominate someone who might win?
Right.
Like,
I mean,
really?
We're saying the same thing about Hillary.
Well, true.
We have the same concerns.
Yes, we do.
To some degree. But, I mean, I, like, also, this is like, in if Ted Cruz is the option that didn't of the guy who has stuck to his guns on immigration.
I know.
We're talking about the guy who also single-handedly shut down the government.
Right, and would do it again in
and
a
would
heartbeat.
Do it again, is planning to, in fact.
That's right,
is leading the charge to do it again.
I
think he's probably looking... I mean, I think shutting down the government is probably part of his electoral strategy at this point.
Because, it is.
Because I think this is where he sees his popularity really kicking in.
Totally.
And if he does that, by all means, run for president, because the rest of America is not going to vote for the person who shut down the government.
Yep.
Meanwhile, Jeb Bush, in maybe a sign that he continues to have no idea what he's talking about,
correct,
made some weird comments about the death penalty.
Yeah.
This. So he says, the headline of every article about this was that he wants death penalty reform. So we all thought to ourselves, hey, good for him.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, we want death penalty reform, too, because we want it gone.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton, P.S., doesn't want death penalty reform. She just wants us to continue using the death penalty.
That's right.
We posted about that recently.
Week. Yeah.
And it was reconfirmed for us this week.
Right.
And so that's why this was on my mind at all, is I was thinking, this is an interesting conundrum for us to find ourselves in. He was on the Meet the Press. He's, reminder, a converted Catholic.
Yes.
The Catholic Church is against the death penalty.
Right.
I will say, for however horrible I think the Catholic Church is, and continues to be even with this new pope, at least they're consistent. They hate abortions and they hate the death penalty. They're against killing of all kinds, as they
see
it. That's at least a consistent position. I can respect it.
Yep.
You know? What I can't respect is Jeb Bush's position, where he is against the baby killing.
Well, it's a confused position.
But is for the death penalty.
Right.
He's for killing the people that are not parasites, but against killing the ones that are.
But he's kind of against it, but also isn't against it. He basically talked his way in and out of it all in the, all in the same interview, basically.
But then ultimately says that it's because it provides closure to the family. Now, I have issues in any sense with the idea that killing someone new in a killing scenario provides closure to anyone.
Right.
I don't think that's a good way to think about killing.
Right. Well, and that is what I think is the problem. I'm surprised he went there with it, because
the retribution element of it should not be the thing that you use to sell it.
No, the thing that you
use to sell it
is you say that it's a deterrent. Now, it's been proven that it's not.
Not a deterrent.
And he even
And he admits at the top of these comments that it's not functioning as a deterrent.
Right, exactly.
But
so
his solution to make it more of a deterrent is to get rid of the appeals process. So basically all of the checks that you would want in place in a final solution such as this.
Right, exactly.
Are going to be eliminated in his reform plan so that we can just more easily kill people.
Correct.
Who cares if they're innocent?
Yeah.
We don't want to have to go through the appeals process to find that out.
It costs too much money to keep people on death row. Let's just, like, get right to it.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just kill those jerks.
Yeah.
But so it's weird that he kind of, like, talks himself out of the supposed reason for it and then into the worst possible reason for it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would argue that this is not even a very Catholic way to think about it.
Well, it's
unequivocally not. The idea that the real benefit of the death penalty is that it provides a sense of closure, that it's for retribution.
That's not it.
That's not it.
No.
That's not it, even if you're just like a nice person.
No.
That's only it if you're a mean person who's absorbed into a kind of anger that we shouldn't indulge as a society.
I agree.
I'm with you. It's just that doesn't...
Yeah.
I'm not for it. Anyway. No. So that was curious. Also, it's Bernie Sanders...
That story is only important because it, you know... Well, it's important for his stance, but it's also important because it's upsetting that he has the same stance on the death penalty that Hillary Clinton does,
I know.
I mean, she doesn't want to get rid of the checks, but I mean, we found out this week. And that's why Black Lives Matter interrupted her, too, by the way. Because she was giving a speech on prison reform.
Right.
And they interrupted it, and it was because of her stance on the death penalty. That's why they said that they did it.
It's a huge racial justice issue.
Of course it is.
Because who is getting killed in the death penalty? Black people.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that.
Yeah.
That's common knowledge.
Yeah.
So, that's another reason, you know, that us on the left or even on the middle left should be against it.
Yeah.
And people on the right should be against it because if the Catholic Church is against it,
right,
then, you know, if the most corrupt institution on the planet can be against it, then it's pretty clear situation.
Yep.
In any case, Bernie Sanders debuted a TV ad for the first time this week.
Yes, he's out with a $2 million TV buy.
That's right.
Ad buy.
60-second spot that is
Called Real Change.
Super boring, but...
I like that. Real Change.
Real Change.
We're back to change.
Yes, thank God. That was working for us before.
Another change election. Who's going to be the change
agent?
Right.
Let's just keep those changes moving left. As long as the changes are moving left, I'm good.
Yeah, exactly.
It focuses on really his entire biography because it's a million hours long and it's not super interesting.
Yeah, 60-second is a long
time. It's just a long time.
Yeah.
But we're excited that he's entering the traditional media game. That shows a kind of clout that he did not used to have. It's going to be airing in New Hampshire and Iowa.
Yeah.
It's sort of showing that he's sort of like competing in the real election now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real election move.
Yeah. See, I could do this in a much shorter time for him, by the way.
P.S.
Which would keep costs lower, too.
Exactly. 60 seconds.
He needs me. That's too long.
It's too long.
It's too long.
When is the Sanders campaign going to just finally call?
I could do it in 10 or less.
So true.
I do it every day.
That's right. Could do this in your sleep for 10 or less.
If I can get people to watch an episode of Below Deck in 10 seconds,
then you can certainly get them to vote for Bernie Sanders.
That's easy. Slam dunk,
exactly.
People. God. Do better.
Anyway. There was also a lot of media... nonsense sensationalizing going on. Sherrod Brown endorsed Hillary Clinton this week. And everyone blew out about it because Sherrod Brown is sort of another far left senator. He's someone who works with Bernie Sanders on legislation all the time. He's the other kind of, he's besides Liz Warren, he's like the other far left person.
Yeah.
And he's from Ohio, which is a swing state.
Yeah.
So it's important.
And Lila had to sort of talk me down from this. And
because, there was no way you could read a story about this and not immediately panic.
No, she did a really good job of it too. And I would like her to do it for you. Now, dear listeners, because...
Here it is, guys. Let's just agree to not be shocked when an establishment Democrat of any stripe endorses the establishment candidate.
Even if they're progressive.
Sherrod Brown needs the DNC to give him money so that he can continue to run for Senate in Ohio.
In Ohio.
A swing state.
Right.
He is a far-left candidate, and we love him very much. But there is no way that a sitting senator that relies on DNC support is going to go behind their back and support the candidate that's fucking up all their plans.
Who's the socialist
independent. Who's the socialist independent, who's, like, ruining their lives.
Sure, he caucuses with them, but he's not one of them.
He's not one of them. That's why he's able to launch this attack on Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Even as much as it's not really an attack on Hillary Clinton, it's an attack on establishment Democratic politics, and that he has that ability, as we've said many times on this podcast, because he is an outsider. He does not rely on the DNC for fundraising. He doesn't rely on them for direction about what he should and should not think. He does not rely on them because he needs someone to caucus with. They need him more than he needs them.
Yeah.
He's a free agent in this process.
Right.
And because he's a free agent in this process, he's a threat to the establishment.
Yeah.
And there is no way that a sitting senator who is part of the establishment, even as much as he is to the left of them largely, he's still a part of the establishment, is going to be going and endorsing Bernie Sanders for president. That's insane to think that would happen.
Yeah.
So as much as the media made this seem like this was the death, you know, the death blow to the Sanders campaign. Yeah. I was like, why would we even have expected Sherrod Brown to endorse him?
As you said to me, you were like, we shouldn't be surprised when Liz Warren supports her either.
No, of course not. Liz Warren is another person who gets leadership posts from the Democrats. She gets money from the DNC. She has met with Hillary Clinton because they were prepping for this very moment. They have to think of a credible way for her to do this, obviously. She can't do it right away. But she's, of course, going to come out for Hillary Clinton because that's what happens when you're part of the party.
Yeah.
And that's what Bernie Sanders, this is the whole point of Bernie Sanders' campaign, is that he doesn't have to play this game.
Right.
So, you know, de Blasio also supported Hillary Clinton. Right. Well, de Blasio fucking ran her campaign in 2000 in the Senate.
Fellow New Yorker.
Right. Let's not say fellow New Yorker. She's a carpetbagger.
I knew that was going to set you off.
But I mean, he's worked for her. Of course, he's a progressive and we like him. But of course, he's going to endorse Hillary Clinton. None of these things are surprising. And Bernie Sanders doesn't need these endorsements. The whole thing that he's running is against this kind of establishment politicking. Yeah. So
don't be panicked.
Be panicked, guys. Everything's fine. No. Everything's cool. He's running a he's doing movement politics. Movement politics don't require establishment people to endorse you.
Right, exactly.
And it's crazy to think otherwise. But I mean, it puts sort of like extra attention on Sherrod Brown's endorsement, obviously. Sherrod Brown he did not endorse in 2008. He didn't have to.
Yeah, that's
true. What was the threat between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? He doesn't need to make an endorsement in that race.
Yeah, right.
You know? Yeah. But obviously someone's been leaning on him to endorse quickly in this race because of this situation.
Yeah.
It's just like...
Well, she's wanting everybody to do it quickly.
Yeah. She needs everyone to do it quickly because she is... As much as she is finally sort of like figuring her shit out, this is embarrassing that this is happening to her.
Yeah.
She has always intended to run on the inevitability of her own win.
Yeah.
And this is very embarrassing what's happening to her. And she needs these people to come in and support her quickly.
Yeah.
But the point is that... The establishment people, and this is what, you know, when I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, Bill Clinton sort of mischaracterizing what the Bernie Sanders phenomenon was about.
When he was on
I think this is something that the establishment Democrats inherently misunderstand about what's happening here.
Yeah.
Is that this campaign sort of plays by their rules and will respond to their games in the way that that people are expected to.
Yeah.
Like no one is looking to find out who Sherrod Brown endorsed.
Endorsed.
No one's ever looked up for that information. Yeah. That's insane to think that that would be the case.
Totally.
In any case, so everyone stay calm.
Yeah.
Also, get yourself onto a list of these new Hillary Clinton emails and find out what else you need to know, because there are some hilarious ones in this newest batch.
Yeah, they're so great. The best one, obviously, was when she needed help with her emojis on on her BlackBerry.
Far and away.
I mean, that was clearly the best. She sent an email to Philip Rhines in 2012, who's one of her senior advisors, and she said, "How did you put that big smiley calm on your email?"
They have this like whole exchange about her getting a new BlackBerry and what he thinks she'll like about it and not like about her new BlackBerry.
And so a couple months later, she emailed him again and she said, here's my question. On this new BlackBerry, can I get smiley faces?
Like really following up on the smiley face situation.
Yeah, exactly. So he responded and said that she could not get smiley faces for email, that she would need to manually type out the characters to form the emoticons.
So he explains how to do that.
Right, exactly. He says, quote, like, colon parentheses for happy. Or, I don't even know what that one is.
These symbols. Dash line if you want to express anger at my tardiness.
Right.
For text messages, the chart might be there in the lower right next to where you type for the message. It's not. I think you can type a smiley face and it might automatically convert it to the symbol.
Try it.
Thank God we got down to the real issues while she was
there. And there was an exchange in Spanish, mysteriously.
Well, he wrote a picture's worth a thousand words in Spanish. This is a Philip Rhines. And then Huma Habedin responded, "Did you send a spam in Spanish?"
Yes. So good.
And then she later emailed, "This looks like an endorsement to go to Cuba."
Exclamation point.
Right. Exclamation point. And he responded, "Yes, that inferred sign of support is not being missed by the press." And then Clinton responded, "Oh, please.
With a bunch of E's and Z's.
A lot of E's and Z's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then his response is redacted.
So good.
Also, there's this hilarious exchange where Anne-Marie Slaughter tells Huma Abedin that her son said that Clinton looks like Lisa Kudrow.
Mm-hmm. High praise indeed.
Pass it on. Then Huma Abedin passes it on, writing, "This is a nice compliment. Lisa is an attractive actress."
Mm-hmm, yes.
And then Clinton's response is fully redacted. But somehow Abedin's response to that email says, "Redacted, whoever it is, certainly thinks you are Cameron Diaz.
Oh, it went from Lisa Kudrow to Cameron Diaz.
Morphed from Lisa Kudrow to Cameron Diaz. Yes. Makes me think they don't know who their blonde actresses are in the State Department.
Could be, yeah. And then there was Hillary Clinton really needed to know how to get a hold of Lady Gaga, because in 2011, there was a CNN blurb where Tim Gunn from Project Runway had criticized her fashion.
Hillary Clinton's fashion.
Yeah, exactly. And so Lady Gaga was on The View, and they asked her about it. She says, you know, I think Hillary Clinton has more things to worry about than her hemline. And then called Tim Gunn a bully. And Hillary Clinton got wind of it and said, can you get an address for her so I can write her a note? She wanted to thank Lady Gaga for defending her on The View.
Fashion choices. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, the fact sagas continue.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton continues to ask Huma Abedin for information about how to use the fax machine, including this time how to use it with a secure connection.
Right, we talked about this once.
This complicated response in return that's half in code and half in typo.
Right, exactly. Because we talked about this once before. She has a long history of fax problems. Like, where there was that whole email exchange about, like, you don't pick up the line, you have to leave it, and then it'll come through. And you, yeah, like, there was a whole exchange.
Here's the thing.
Exchange.
How did she get through the 90s not knowing how to operate a fax machine?
Right, exactly.
I can understand if Brent or I didn't know how to operate a fax machine.
And how is she
when
getting...
When do you ever use fax machines
and how
in
is she? And how is she getting through 2012 still having to use one?
Wait, I haven't needed to know that I don't know how to use a fax machine recently, because I haven't had to use one.
No.
It's so rare that you have to operate a fax machine.
Correct.
Yeah. And we live in a world where you can email documents that are scanned to yourself fairly easily. A lot of things are replacing the fax machine.
It scares me that this is going on as much as it was in the State
Department. It's a perfect metaphor for what happens in government, according to most Americans.
Yeah.
There was also sort of like a hilarious exchange that she was visiting Bulgaria in 2012, and there was like this weird flare-up because the prime minister of Bulgaria said something weird about her hair, because there's like a proverb that has to do with like a woman's hair like having to like represent
her
mood
or something.
And so then the U.S. ambassador had to write this whole email being like, he wasn't trying to offend you.
Right.
He's sorry. Like, he didn't mean it the way you think he means it, because he had insulted her hair.
Yeah.
Huma Abedin's response, this is hysterical.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I can understand why she might have been a little miffed about that, because, like, look, we've been talking about her hair for decades now.
Too much.
We've been talking about her hair. We've been talking about her headbands. She's got some
her
hair history.
Her fashion choices, many of them poor, have been dissected for decades.
Exactly. So I get it.
Right. We're with her on that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this week she announced that she was shaking up her press operation a little bit. I think probably because everyone's just exhausted.
Probably.
These email releases. Like, can you imagine how much more sort
work
they have to do on the Clinton side just to keep up with all this email nonsense?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a whole separate... They're running a whole separate operation just having to, like, deal with that, basically.
Yeah.
Like, so that's outside of the campaign. Is like, I mean, it's part of the campaign, but yeah.
It's not uncommon for a campaign to do this kind of press shakeup at this point, but I imagine her people are extra tired.
I'm sure, yes.
Because, like, why wouldn't they be?
Yeah, exactly.
And then also... We're mentioning this as a side note, because we hate talking about foreign policy, but we felt we should mention it.
Yeah.
It's not relevant. It's a non sequitur, but we're going to talk about it.
We're doing it anyway.
We're sending troops to Syria.
Oh, perfect.
Yay.
Yeah.
Troops. Why? Because
so Obama ISIL doing the one thing that
ISIS,
we elected
or whatever
him
we're
not
calling
to
them
do.
Now are terrible.
Yeah.
Kerry was asked about it, because he was in, like, Uzbekistan or something this week, and he was like, well, because shit's hitting the fan.
Right. Well, because they were all there talking about what to do about Syria.
Right.
That's
no,
what they were.
It was
like
a
them
meeting.
And a bunch. Them and all of the countries except Syria talking about what to do about Syria.
A
by
classic
the way.
A classic scenario. A classic developed world scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in any case, now we're sending troops in, which is
great.
A delight. As you can imagine, we're super enthused about that.
Yeah.
Here's, though, the best news story of the week.
Oh, boy. Wasn't
in other ever. Military news.
Yeah.
A military blimp that had a yearning to break free.
did
so this week.
Yeah.
And went on a joyride around Pennsylvania.
Yeah. This, like, has a very sort of, like, Disney movie aspect to it, sort of,
it really
doesn't
does.
It? Like, the you know, the,
well,
the very, the very
like
happy
giants.
Military blimp or
exactly.
something, you know? Like, yeah.
Around noon on Wednesday, an Army surveillance blimp got untethered in the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland and just started, like, drifting over Pennsylvania at 16,000 feet. Now, nobody knows what to do when a blimp breaks loose.
Right, because
what do you do? So they put two F-16s just, like, in the area to, like, keep an eye on things, but no one was really sure what the plan was because they didn't want it to blow up.
Right.
Because blimps can explode.
Yeah.
All that helium isn't something that you want to just, like, put fire in.
No.
So So they just sort of were, like, flying around near the blimp, quote, supervising the situation, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But the blimp also had 6,700 feet of cable trailing off of it, so it was knocking down power lines right, as it
like,
roamed.
The power was going out, like, so a lot of places on the east,
over
east coast.
Pennsylvania, people were losing power because this blimp was dragging a power dragging a cable around, knocking down power lines.
So good.
It's part of this very long-winded acronym. That is an army program. Yeah. That's a surveillance program that people are pretty much against because it's like sneaky
yeah,
and horrible.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's called the Army's Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netting Sensor System. Come on.
Get real.
That can't be the name of your program.
No.
We're not Soviet Russia. That's not.
Or JLens.
Or JLens, which is what they call
it
for sure.
It can't be JLens because there's like 17
words
in that.
Yeah, they miss out missile. They take out missile defense.
They took out a lot of words.
They took out system.
To get to JLens.
No, they had to because they couldn't say. Yeah. I mean, how would you get an acronym with that many letters in it? It would be a sentence. So, and then the manufacturer of the blimp says in promotional material for JLens that there's a number of procedures in place in case something like this happens. Mm-hmm. But no one knew what those procedures were, evidently.
Yeah.
The blimp finally crashed, and then they shot a bunch of holes in it to get rid of the excess helium. And then I think today they finally cleaned it up fully. But Slate, I think, put it best when they said, how many government, because they called every government agency to figure out what to do, because no one knew what to do. How many government agencies does it take to recover a marauding danger blimp?
I love marauding danger blimp. Best. Yeah. But it finally broke into pieces and crashed in Muncie, Pennsylvania.
But this was the day of the Republican debate. So then Mike Huckabee tried to use it in a weird metaphor about the government being a blimp that's flying away.
That was too full of hot air, but too big to be able to shoot down. And it was, like, really rambling and quite unsuccessful as far as I'm concerned.
I see
it got a big
was
round of applause because, like,
well,
everybody
everyone
was obsessed
into the blimp
with the blimp at the time.
The blimp story, by the way, was one of those stories that for 3 hours I was hooked.
Oh, yeah. Everybody
couldn't
was
think of anything
like,
else.
It was trending on Twitter. It was, like,
this
it was
like,
really
as the baby debate was starting, we were just hearing about the final moments of the blimp.
Yeah.
And, like, I couldn't have cared less about the baby debate at that point.
Well, I know. Yeah, exactly.
The kitty debate was of no interest to me because there was a roaming blimp.
It was not very interesting anyway.
It was also not very interesting. Anyway, in final news, we've promised my mother that we will make sure to include our endorsement for Don Hebbard for town council in Franklin, New York.
Hey, we never endorse anybody.
We never endorse anybody, so we're doing it.
Yeah.
There is
we watched his video. Seems lovely.
If you are a Franklin listener, all seven of you, you can check out more information at the Franklin Party Facebook page.
Yeah.
That's the party he's running under. He's running for town council because there are issues with a pipeline in the area that they don't want to approve, but that they have, and they want to put a compressor station in Franklin, and that's going to be a disaster.
No, that doesn't sound good at all.
We want someone who cares about the environment of Franklin to be on the town council,
because
Franklin is beautiful.
Yeah, and it's Don Hebbard.
And though I'm allergic to most of it, I still respect that it's a beautiful place to live.
Right.
And that's Don Hebbard. So check out that. And if you live in a town that has a similar situation, write in. We'll endorse your anti-compressor station pipeline candidate also.
Exactly.
We're not afraid.
Nope.
We're anti-compressor stations and pipelines, so sue us.
Big time.
In any case, that's the news this week. We'll be back next week with the other news of next week.
Well said.
Thank you. Bye.